Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, recently we did a show about a major archaeological discovery on the banks of the Miami River in downtown Miami, Florida. This week's show is also about a major archaeological discovery, actually a much more significant one, although it's not in the heart of a major American city, but is instead in the heart of a nearly impenetrable jungle in Guatemala. So I guess we're on a roll with archaeology. This is a fascinating story about a vast city complex that was the capital of the ancient Mayan civilization, a site that was first known about a century ago, but the importance of which was not recognized until pretty recently, and which is actually much older than the well-known Mayan temple sites like Chichen Itza and Tikal. The main city is called El Mirador, and it's only one of many ancient cities that have recently been discovered in an area known as the Mirador Basin. My guest is Dr. Richard Hansen, the director and lead researcher of the Mirador Basin Project and an affiliate research professor at Idaho State University. He'll tell us the whole story. Welcome, Richard.
Hi, Court. It's nice to be with you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, thanks so much to you for being on with us. I know you're heading back down to Central America just tonight, I think.
Yes,
so really
yes.
Appreciate you being on. Well, let's start with a quick overview. So where is the Mirador Basin and how big is it?
It's in extremely northern Guatemala in southern Campeche, Mexico. Actually, it crosses the border. And half the basin's on the Guatemalan side and the other half is on the Campeche, Mexico side of the line. And it covers about 1.6 million acres of pristine forest.
Oh my gosh, huge amount of land. So is it inhabited? I mean, are there indigenous
people
there?
Not one person lives in that entire area.
Oh, Lord, that's huge.
It's the last intact area left in Central America. And it's something we've been struggling to conserve and protect because of the quantity of ancient cities located in this basin, which is surrounded by a ridge of karstic hills, by the way. So it's a contained system. It was a contained system anciently. It's a contained system ecologically. It's a contained system geologically. It's all contained within this one geological marvel that's found in northern Guatemala and southern Mexico, extreme northern Guatemala.
Yeah, so it sounds like the legend of Shangri-La, almost like a hidden area that's ringed by mountains and kind of a mystical place down below. But so, what's been discovered there? Just kind of in an overview way.
Well, we've been working up there now for 42 years. I've mapped and excavated in 56 ancient cities in the area. We knew there was a lot more than that, but I had to prove it. And because of the work that was done in Belize by Dr. Arlen Chase and Diane Chase in Belize, who used LIDAR, I realized that this was the unique opportunity to demonstrate the quantity of ancient cities in this basin. So in 2015, we launched the first LIDAR flights through the heart of the Mirador Basin. And then in 2018, we did the entirety of the basin on the Guatemalan side of the border and came up with 964 archaeological sites. Some of those sites belong to the same polity. We could tell that by internal causeways or by shared reservoirs or shared canals and whatnot. So by combining those sites, we came up with 417 ancient cities, towns, and villages that are found nestled in the heart of the Mirador Basin on the Guatemalan side of the border. To the west are very few sites. To the east are also fewer sites. And in the Campeche, there's a huge bajo, a huge swamp called the Bajo del Laberinto. And that is near Calakmul. And there's fewer sites on the Mexican side of the border than there is farther south. What's astonishing, though, is that these cities are thousands of years earlier than all of the great cities you'll see in Mexico or Guatemala or Honduras or Belize. These sites date to the pre-classic period, centuries before the time of Christ. And our first evidence of occupation in the area is consistent about 2600 BC, but they're only raising corn. We have corn pollen from those samples, but they're not building anything other than perishable houses. And they're not sedentary. They're moving around. By about 1000 BC, though, they start building platforms and permanent constructions and permanent settlements. And by 800 BC, they're building large platforms with pyramids up to 24 meters high. And so what it allows us to see is the evolution of a complex society that we've never seen before. And this is a remarkable laboratory to see how this all fit together. When we did the LIDAR, which is light range and detecting studies of this area, it penetrates the jungle and allows us to see 100% of every single feature. We used a high precision LIDAR because we were terrified that we'd do a very expensive study. And because of the dense canopy of the forest, we wouldn't be able to get the results we wanted. However, by using that high-resolution LIDAR, we were able to see all of these cities and all the platforms and causeways. And what it revealed in this paper that was published in the journal Ancient Mesoamerica by Cambridge University Press, it let us see all these ancient cities all together at once at all of the huge superhighways that link them all together in a complex web of interaction. And that was the astonishing thing to see 110 miles of causeways, 40 to 50 yards wide and 2 to 6 yards high that linked all these cities together in the basin. And that's what opened our eyes into the magnificence and the urgency to protect and conserve this area for future generations of Guatemalans and future visitors from the world.
All right. So, yeah, LIDAR, I know, has really revolutionized archaeology, especially in jungle areas, because as you say, it allows you to penetrate through that thick jungle vegetation, the tree cover and the jungle vegetation below, to see the actual objects on the ground as if it's magically stripped away. So it's really been a huge jump forward in discovery based on that technology. So that's a cool thing. And let's look at El Mirador, which is the main, let's call it the capital city of that huge civilization that you described with hundreds and hundreds of villages and even cities. How big is El Mirador itself in land area?
Well, the actual size itself is about 132 square kilometers of monumental architecture. By monumental architecture, everything of 5 meters or larger high. And 132 square kilometers is of the civic center of an ancient city is huge.
Yeah.
One of the largest ancient cities in the entire Western Hemisphere.
Wow. So how many people lived in that area, El Mirador and the surrounding cities at their height? Do we know?
Well, we know that there must have been millions in the pre-classic period. The reason we came up with those numbers so gigantic, and I think El Mirador may have had 300,000 or 400,000 people at one time. We came up with those numbers because of the number of contemporaneous structures that were built simultaneously. And these huge, massive buildings and enormous platforms required the labor of thousands and thousands of rock carriers and architects and laborers to build all this stuff, plus all the system to feed and water them.
So it's like, you know, it's equivalent to the pyramids or even more because there are only some of them over a longer period of time. And this is an even more complex undertaking, it sounds like. So here's a question. If there were once several million people comprising a thriving and sophisticated civilization there in the heart of this jungle 2,000 years ago or whatever it was, what happened to it? Why did it basically disappear? Do we know?
Well, yes, we do. That's one of the things we've been working on. Understand, it's important to understand what gave their rise to complexity? What was it that was the catalyst for their prosperity and for their demographic density? And we discovered it to be these swamps, these marsh, wet marshland swamps that dominate the area. These swamps were extremely rich biologically. They did have water, but more importantly, it had the rich organic mud that they would haul and build in thousands of kilometers of terrace systems. And that gave them the agricultural propensity to have the economic wealth it took to do all this. Now, because of their agricultural capability in this area, you know, the question is, why weren't they living on the edge of a lake or a river somewhere like all other great civilizations? But it was those swamps were key to that. Now, what we find when we dig in those swamps today, we find that rich organic layer under meters of sterile clay, a huge sedimentation out there that buried that rich organic swamp muck under meters of sterile clay, which required some kind of a massive deforestation. And we suspected it was lime production. The burning of limestone to make quicklime, it's a chemical process converting limestone into a quicklime powder that can be mixed with water and then reformed again into calcium carbonate. And that required the deforestation of all their jungle, the natural clays washed down into those swamps and buried that rich organic layer under meters of sterile clay. So they essentially destroyed themselves. The question isn't so much why did they leave? The question is, why didn't they come back? And there's two words that are important with that, abandonment or collapse. And abandonment is always because of warfare or disease or drought, because after the stress is gone, they always come back. But a collapse is when they leave and don't come back for hundreds, if not thousands of years later. And this is what we're seeing in the Mirador Basin. This was a collapse of complex societies, and they never recovered in the southern part of the basin.
Well, imagine if, as you're saying, the clay that was generated probably from the deforestation that it took to make the quicklime that they used as mortar in building their temples and their buildings, if rainwater then caused the clay up above the swamp to run off into the swamp and cover it, then that was a non-reversible process, basically, and they couldn't get at the muck that that they needed to grow their crops. So I guess that's what drove them out. And if there were millions of people, they had to disperse somewhere else, and probably they were, I don't know, you know, I can imagine other tribes would absorb them or kill them, and, you know, who knows. But anyway, that's probably why they didn't come back, I would
think.
Well,
it looks like they went toward the coast, and I don't know if we can say millions. I may be safer in saying there were hundreds of thousands of people in this area, and I think that's a safe number than the millions. But it looks like they went to the Atlantic coast, which would be a natural refuge if you're living off under stress. There were multiple factors. There's no single factor in a collapse. There's always a perfect storm that's generated by a series of factors simultaneously. But the fact that they couldn't recover that rich organic swamp mud meant they couldn't renovate their fields easily. Plus, you'd have, because of massive deforestation, you would affect the rainfall patterns and create drought scenarios. And if you have corn and I don't have corn, guess who's coming to visit you? You see. So there was warfare scenarios that were probably because of chaos and social upheavals because of the stresses placed on from all of these factors that are working simultaneously. It looks like they went to the Caribbean coast. And from there, that looks like a group returned to a site called Xibanche in Quintana Roo. And then from Xibanche, they returned back to their basin. But they couldn't settle in the southern part. They settled in the northern part where the pre-classic occupation had been much less, and they formed the great capital city of Calakmul in that area. So that's kind of the general model that we're looking at and how this system may have worked and what happened in that historical part. And Calakmul became a superpower. They were the absolute rivals of Tikal. So they were thriving back in the basin again. And the kings of Calakmul called themselves the kings of Khan. But the name of Calakmul was never Khan. The name of Calakmul was Cheeknab. So we think that they have a reference to their ancient legacy, which was the Khan kingdom that was farther south in the Mirador area.
Well, it's amazing you can put all that together from archaeological data. After so much time, it's just kind of like a puzzle. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Richard Hansen about a massive archaeological site in northern Guatemala and southern Mexico called El Mirador and the Mirador Basin, and a whole Mayan civilization that existed there between, I guess, 1,000 and 2,000 years ago or something like that. And well, how long... Let me ask you this. Who were the first modern people to ever see signs of ancient human habitation in the Mirador Basin? Was it pretty recent or a long time ago?
No, it happened. The first people out there were the mappers that made the border between Campeche and Guatemala. And they noted the presence of large ruins in 1882. But nobody really got out there. It's really uninhabitable. There are no roads. There are no villages in there. In fact, not one person lives in the entirety of the basin. Yeah. So it wasn't until 1930 that an aerial expedition from the University of Pennsylvania was flying between Campeche and Chetumal. And they saw what looked like volcanoes on the horizon. So they diverted their course and flew around what they thought were volcanoes in a dolomitic limestone context, which would be extremely unusual.
Yeah.
Only to discover that they're big blocks. They could see the big stonework, that these were huge and massive pyramids. And they took pictures of these images, if you can imagine that, in 1930. Yeah. But it wasn't until 1962 that Ian Graham of Harvard hiked in there and located the sites and made a brief map of the sites that was published in 1967. And then because of the remote nature and the hard to get to and actually out there, we're part of the food chain. Nobody really got back into until Bruce Dahlin entered with a small team from Catholic University in 1978. And I was invited with Dr. Ray Matheny to come in 1979. And we started major excavations at Mirador in 1979 to 1983. Then I received the invitation from the Guatemalan government to come back in and do a regional study in 1987. And I've been in that basin since 1987, constantly every year.
So it's been pretty much your life's work from the time you were a young man and early in your academic career.
Yeah, wow. It's been a real opportunity, though, to try to understand the formation of complex societies, the dynamics that maintain them, and the reasons for their collapse.
So were you the first to realize that the El Mirador site was much older than was originally thought? I think there's a kind of a little story there. I'm asking a rhetorical question. I know the answer to, but just kind of briefly, what was that eureka moment?
Ian Graham thought these cities were poor cousins in the classic period. And he thought that the severe damage to the buildings and the more ruined appearance of the buildings was because they may have used a poor mortar. But in 1962, Dr. Joyce Marcus of the University of Michigan went with Dr. Graham, and they did a couple of test pits and stored the ceramics in the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. And the Maya ceramicist Donald Forsyth went to that and noted that there was a high concentration of extremely early ceramics in that sample. Well, when we got to Mirador in 1979, I've been working in architecture in Israel. I worked in architecture in the Four Corners area of the United States. They asked me to tackle a large structure that was in the Tigray complex, about 17 meters high. And when I dug that building, I came down on the floor and found the pre-classic pottery sitting right on the floor of the building, which was, everybody assumed that this building, since it was so, it had still had air ventilation systems and cornice stones, it was still visible. They were assuming that it was a classic period building, because at that time, the pre-classic Maya were simply hunters and gatherers. They weren't building huge, elaborate, complex cities of any type. And when I found that pre-classic pottery right on the floor of the building, I realized then that the whole model for the evolution of Maya civilization was in error. There was a problem with that. And that's why I spent 42 years trying to understand that. What were the processes that led to such magnificent complexity, economically, politically, and socially, before the rest of the Maya world got on board?
Interesting. So, yeah, so you figured out when you found the old material sitting on the floor of what was supposed to be a newer building.
That's
right. Couldn't be the case. It
That's
had to be
right.
an old building too. So
that's exactly pretty, right.
Pretty cool. So What have been the most important discoveries? I mean, apart from the complex itself and so on, but I mean, you know, from a large, big picture standpoint, what's the, you just described one, that the whole thing is much older than thought, you know, so that's a big discovery. But even small discoveries, what have been some that really were mind-blowing things? And just a couple, because we're kind of getting toward the end of the show here.
Well, we have found incredible monuments. We've found extraordinary architectural art. We've found a frieze, a stucco frieze that depicts scenes from the Popol Vuh, the creation story of the Maya, but dates to 300 BC. Beautiful art, beautifully and well-protected art. We have discovered royal burials at Tintal, and we've discovered right now we're working on the DNA with the Harvard DNA Laboratory to understand the interaction of people and the relationship of societies within the basin. The most exciting discovery has perhaps been this LIDAR work, because it shows the macro view of this complex society. Rather than looking at a single episode, we're looking at the entire story simultaneously. And to see all these causeways linking all these cities together, forming a complex web of economic and political and social interaction. And by the way, none of those causeways go outside the borders of the basin, which gives us then the opportunity to look at the evolution of a complex society. Why are societies living in Burma or the Amazon in the exact same environment, still hunting and gathering societies? And yet the Maya developed one of the most complex and sophisticated ancient civilizations in the history of the world. And that's the challenge we have academically, the challenge we have scientifically, the challenge we have to understand that process. But not only that, we have the obligation to provide and justify the conservation and long-term protection of this area for generations of Guatemalans.
Yeah, so that's interesting that, you know, you can look at other peoples, other civilizations around the same time that didn't advance nearly as quickly or as impressively as the Mayan did. And so what was the difference? I guess that's your, you kind of gotten to where you can see the forest and now you see the trees and you understood the what, but now you got to get to the how.
That's
or
right.
Something. So it's another level of it. So do these findings give us a better idea of what life was like for Mayans at that time? I mean, what were some of the main features of day-to-day life then that we can discover from what you found?
Well, we know that they had excellent diet. Through the LIDAR, we discovered they even had construction pens for the production of an industrial level of meat for those local populations. We find the evidence of isotope data tells that they were primarily corn societies, but we find they were eating dog, they were eating deer, they were eating fish from the Caribbean Ocean. They were probably salted and brought in. We find exotic materials from all over Mesoamerica, including jade, obsidian, basalt, and granite, exotic seashells. They're all being transported and brought into these cities. And what it shows us is a remarkable centralization of authority to control the labor involved in the construction of all these ancient cities, plus the construction of the causeways. I mean, these are super highways 50 yards wide. So to imagine the control of that labor was phenomenal. But it created a remarkable inequality that allowed them to grow and prosper that in a way that had never been seen before in Latin America or in the Americas. And the story of humanity is repeated there in that kind of remarkable visibility.
Amazing. So we are down to the last couple of minutes. Unfortunately, this is one of those shows that we could easily go for another half hour. But are there any tourists there yet at all? I mean, I think it's, you know, deep in the heart of a jungle and they'd have to get there by helicopter. But and how do you envision the ecotourism aspect of the project evolving as time goes on?
Well, yes, there is. There's about right now, and before the pandemic, they had about 5,000 people a year hiking in there. It's a 2 to 3 day hike one way to get into those cities. And now those numbers are almost back up there again. About 5,000 people hiking in. And they contract with the cooperative in Carmelita or then Washoktun, or there's tourism companies that have specialized tours that take people in there on mules and on foot to see these remarkable ancient cities. The other option is a 40-minute flight from Flores in a helicopter, and you spend the day. And unfortunately, when you do that, you don't get to see as much as you would see if you'd hiked in, because the helicopters fly back in late afternoon. A huge city like this, I mean, you don't see all of the fronts that we have exposed and are visible to see. But
you don't get to slap nearly as many mosquitoes.
That's exactly right. That's right.
So, but I mean, I think you have, you know, again, just very briefly, a vision of how ecotourism can keep this place from being despoiled by the usual things that happen, like logging and deforestation and farming and looting and, you know, drug dealers and so on, by providing an alternate kind of economy. So is that something that's beginning to evolve?
Well, anymore, we cannot say rainforest because it's pretty and green. Those old romantic notions aren't reality in the real world. We have to be able to justify that conservation economically. And a controlled ecotourism would provide hundreds of years of employment for thousands of Guatemalans and improve at the same time the conservation. We're proposing and suggesting to the government of Guatemala that they develop the first cultural and natural sanctuary in all of Latin America, meaning no roads and no airstrips. The reason for that, it would involve the communities that surround the basin in the economic models. It would improve by far the conservation of the area and dramatically improve the prosperity of the country and the local regions. And that's the suggestion that we have. That's the recommendation we have. We have been attacked by an organized mafia in Latin America that do not want the security and conservation of that area. And they've attacked us incessantly because this has tremendous importance to organized crime, to launder money and to move illicit products through the jungles to the north. By making a roadless wilderness area, we neutralize those factors and to where they cannot, we can conserve this area and reduce that organized crime influence.
Yeah, so apart from doing the science and the research, you've also got a political battle on that side with a government that's possibly shaky. So
yeah,
interesting.
That's true. There's elections this year. We are hoping that the new government will have a broader view of the importance of the long-term conservation, the importance of local and community prosperity, the importance of preservation and conservation of this unique cultural and natural wonder that's found there.
Well, let's hope optimistically that that takes place and they go along with your vision and that it comes to fruition. But Dr. Richard Hansen, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being on with us in American Variety talking about El Mirador. And by the way, you can go to YouTube and search El Mirador and you'll see lots of videos of the various sites and parts of the Mirador Basin project. And thanks again, Dr. Hansen.
That's great. Thank you very much, Court. Appreciate the opportunity.
I sure appreciate it. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place for more American Variety Radio.